spread. There's an unspoken fear. We're on our way down. We must take America back. Main Street to Wall Street.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Agent for Truth radio show, brought to you courtesy of the Truth Frequency Radio Network. I am the Agent for Truth, Joe Bannister, your host. You can see more about me at agentfortruth.com and freedomabovefortune.com. I always dedicate every show to our Father in Heaven, so let us pray together as Jesus instructed us in Matthew chapter 6. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our debts as we forgive our debtors. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. Amen. Well, we are lucky to have again our favorite guest, attorney Larry Beecraft from Huntsville, Alabama. Welcome, Larry.
Hello, Joe. How are you doing?
I'm doing excellent. Thanks for coming on. What we're doing is, back in March, we had a show with Larry where we went into some interesting history about the income tax. Going all the way back to the 1913 alleged ratification of the 16th Amendment. But, of course, we don't deal so much with that. Okay, if they want to say it's ratified, fine, we'll work with that. And then the income tax acts that came after the 16th Amendment back in 1913. So Larry's going to give a brief, super brief recap of what we did back in March, and then now we're going to dig even deeper. And so, Larry, go ahead and take it away.
Well, Joe, the point of the discussion during that last program was centered upon, an effort on my part to kind of tie it all together. Joe, you've heard that old expression, a trite adage, that it has a lot of truth to it. If you ignore history, then you're doomed to repeat it. Now, the same thing applies to the income tax laws. They are interrelated. You know, one of the things that really irritates me about both the tax professional industry, you know, that means the tax accountants, the tax lawyers, the people in government that administer the tax, they all operate off the current code. But the same thing also applies to people in the tax movement. You know, the people that are sitting down and trying to study, they likewise do the same thing as the IRS and the tax professionals. They limit their studies to just the current code. Now, there's a real problem with that. You know, a lot of understanding of this issue relates to how it has grown. You got to start out at the beginning and see the little changes over time, get to see how it grows. And also, I have shown these things to other people, and they say it's a whole lot clearer, you know, it's a whole lot more readily understood. It's clear if you go back to the old stuff to see how it looked when it was not as complicated. And in fact, you know, it's a whole lot easier to understand. You know, right now I'm looking at, you know, a PDF image of one of the tax acts on the screen, and it's less than 100 pages long. However, if you pull up the current code right now, you know, as a PDF image, it'll be about 3,000 pages long. So there's a big difference in the amount of material that you have to study if you start off at the very beginning. But then again, if you encompass all of the acts, including the current code, you know, you got a whole lot to study. But there are things, there are routes that you can take to go through all these acts that makes it simple to understand. But the simple fact of the matter is that here's the way that all this was created. Let's start off at the present. The 1986 code that everybody uses for the income tax and all other federal income taxes, Title 26, the United States Code, you know, that is the 86 code. And when you go back to how did the 86 code come into being, there was a law in 1986 that just simply changed the name of the 1954 code to the 1986 code. So the 86 code is nothing more than the 54 code renamed. Well, what was the 1954 code? Well, in August of 1954, Congress comes along and enacts the 1954 Internal Revenue Code. Well, it was nothing more than a recompilation of the 1939 Internal Revenue Code. Imagine whatever the 39 code looked like in August of 1954. Imagine taking that code and cutting up all the sections. And then even taking a lot of the sections and cutting them up into subsections. So you would have a whole lot of pieces of paper lying around after you got through cutting up the 1939 Internal Revenue Code. Now also take them like a, take all those pieces of paper like a deck of cards and shuffle them. That would be the 1954 code. It's nothing more than a reshuffling of the provisions of the 1939 code. Well, the 1939 code was nothing more than an effort. You know, it's, you know, there's criticism in this movement about codifications. People don't understand what codifications are. Codifications are a whole lot easier to work with the law rather than sitting there and saying, you know, like if you're, here's what the law is currently. Well, it's, you know, this law was first enacted in 1918 and it was modified by some act in 1925 and then again in 1936 it was amended and in 1948 it was amended. You know, if you cited things that way, it, you know, you'd create a mess. And so the reason we codify the law is we take all of the existing law as it currently appears, break all the existing law up into subject matter categories, and then put them all in one one book. And then we call each little book a title, so that we have all of the current federal law that's in effect. It's published in 50 titles. It's also published in the statutes at large. You know, well, why would somebody want to look at the statutes at large when you got to piece it all together? It's all pieced together by the titles of the code. But in 1939, what Congress did is they simply took all of the existing tax acts and put them all in one act of Congress. And they call that the 1939 Internal Revenue Code. Well, the income tax came from the Revenue Act of 1938. Well, in fact, a whole bunch of the acts that were in the 1938 Act went into the 1939 Code. But when you take a look at the 1938 Act and look at in reference to the income tax, tax imposed, you know, that tax was imposed in lieu of the tax imposed by the Revenue Act of 1936. Well, when you go back to the Revenue Act of 1936 and take a look at tax imposed, that was in lieu of the 34 tax. The 34 tax was in lieu of the 32 tax. The 32 tax was in lieu of the 1928 tax. The 28 tax was in lieu of the 1926 tax. The 26 tax was in lieu of the 1924 tax. That was in lieu of the 1921 tax. And that was in lieu of the 1918 tax, which was a tax imposed in lieu of the 1916 and 1917 tax. So now let's move forward into time. All this is interrelated. The Supreme Court says that when you're dealing with particularly the tax laws, you construe them in pari materia with each other. Pari, P-A-R-I, that's one word, materia, M-A-T-E-R-I-A. That's a Latin phrase. It just means you construe it all together. So if you're dealing with a tax law, the Supreme Court says you can't ignore the history of a provision. And indeed, that is true because the only way you can really understand it is to study that history. Not only the history that you will see by looking at prior provisions, similar provisions in the old tax acts, but then you can also look at the regulations that went along with all of those tax acts. And incidentally, for the benefit of our listeners, if you go over to the Truth Law Library, you can download all of the old tax acts and all of the old regulations. They're posted there. However, it's far more convenient for people to get from you a CD. Stick it in your computer. And when that CD gets pulled up, you hit this HTML file, you know, that's on that CD, and everything is linked. So it's extremely beneficial to have all of this on a CD, and then you can study it. You can pull up all of the old tax acts. They're word searchable. And you can pull up all the old tax regulations, and they as well are word searchable. So now let's go back and re-summarize everything. In 1913, after the 16th Amendment had been allegedly ratified, in October 1913, Congress passes the first income tax under the 16th Amendment. Well, after the Bruchhaber decision came out in 1916, Congress came along and repealed the 1913 Act and imposed a new income tax in October of 1916, the Revenue Act of 1916. Well, the following year, since we were engaged in World War I, the Revenue Act of 1917, you know, basically increased, it amended the 1916 Act. And starting from that point forward, with the Revenue Act of 1918, which was enacted in 1919, from that point forward, starting with that act, everything was in lieu of. So in 1918, they imposed tax in lieu of the tax imposed by the Revenue Acts of 1916 and 1917. A couple of years later, 1921, they passed an act that was in lieu of the 1918 tax. In 24, they passed a tax that was in lieu of the 1921 tax. In 1926, they passed a tax in lieu of the 1924 tax. In 1928, they passed a tax in lieu of the 1926 tax. In 1932, they passed a tax act that was in lieu of the 1928 tax. In 34, it was in lieu of 32. In 36, it was in lieu of 34. In 1938, it was in lieu of 1936 tax. So it's all connected. You know, from 1916 forward, everything is in lieu of, including going into the codifications. In 1939, February 1939, Congress, you know, they had all these tax acts scattered hither and yon throughout the statutes at large. And so they made a decision. Hey, let's put it all these tax acts into one law, and thereafter we just have to amend that one.
Larry, point out the in lieu of versus repealed, because I think that's important for people to for sure understand.
Well, you know, what they've done, you know, whatever tax was imposed in 1916, when they came along in 1918 and said this tax is in lieu of, the subject doesn't change. You know, they just typically broaden the provisions about how the tax operates. It's still on the same subjects. So, you know, in lieu of means in substitute for. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Okay. You know, so they, you know, they keep the same tax scheme in effect. And then later on, they say, well, in lieu of that old tax, we hereby impose on the same subjects this tax. And typically, you know, they're moving up or down, or they're adjusting, rather, the tax rates. But then again, you know, the as time goes along, you can see that from experience, or they're learning from experience in reference to the administration of the tax. And so as the years go by, you know, they kind of clarify things that need to be clarified. You know, like, for example, by 1926, you know, they realize they got so many tax cases and controversies over income taxes that they need a tax court, so a tax court gets created. You know, but then they learn from experience, you know, collecting taxes, you know, the problems that can come up with reference to that, so they improve the statutes. But then again, quite often, when they improve things, they make it a lot more complicated. So does that make sense, Joe?
Yes, I understand.
Okay. Now, hey, I want to, even though we covered some of these issues in the prior show, I want to get into something specific that shows the value of doing these types of studies in the old tax acts. Now, Joe, before this program, I emailed to you four different PDF files. One deals with, you know, they're called extracts of tax acts income, and then another one's in lieu of, and another one's liable, and another one relates to remuneration. And what I have done with those files, you know, so that people don't have to sit down and look at, you know, and piece through, you know, a lot of pages and all these acts, I just, for these specific little points, I extracted the pages and then I strung them together in one file, you know, everything that relates to one point. Like, for example, can you pull up that file called Liable Extracts of Tax Acts?
Yeah.
Liable?
Yes, but
okay.
Let's also point out to the listeners that if they don't have a CD with them, if they go to truth-attack.com, the Truth Attack website, and go to Law Library, and the menu item called Primary Sources of Law, you will see the documents that Larry's going to refer to. Although he's referring to a truncated version, I just want to point out to the listeners, Larry, that if they go to Primary Sources of Law, under the Law Library section of the truth-attack.com website, they're going to find the documentation that you're referring to.
And these very same files, are you saying the very same files are posted there?
No, you're using a summary form that you've emailed to me, but just to let people know that the longer versions are at that point on the Truth Attack.
Yeah, they're posted, the whole acts are posted there.
Right. So then,
now, Joe, here's the thing that I want to make a point about. You know, being liable for a tax is real important. Well, then seeing who was statutorily liable in the old tax acts, you know, I think it's beneficial to study that precise issue. And if you pull up that file that I emailed to you, extracts tax acts liable, you'll see what I'm talking about.
Got it.
Now, let me explain, you know, why being liable is so blooming important. You know, in the 1040 instruction booklet, in compliance with federal laws that are applicable to government agencies, you know, Paperwork Reduction Act and the Administrative Procedures Act and things like that. The IRS has come out with some notices that appear in the 1040 instruction booklet. Now, they identify, the IRS, it identifies three laws that relate to the obligation to file income tax returns. If you sit down and read the Paperwork Reduction Act and Privacy Act notice, that notice says, our legal right, referring to the IRS, our legal right to ask you for information is 6001, 6011, 6012 of the Internal Revenue Code and their regulations. They say that you must file a return statement with us for any tax that you are liable for. Well, the IRS says you're liable. You know, that you have to be liable in order to be required to file a return. Now, when you turn to Section 6001 of the Internal Revenue Code, the section that they cite in the Privacy Act notice, and when you sit down and read it, it says, every person liable for any tax imposed by this title, or with respect to the collection thereof, shall keep such records, render such statements, make such returns, comply with such rules and regulations as the Secretary may from time to time prescribe. Well, you can plainly see it doesn't say every American liable. It says for whoever is liable. And then when you take a look at Section 6011, you know, when required by regulations prescribed by the Secretary, any person made liable shall make a return or statement according to the forms and regulations prescribed by the Secretary. Again, that section says that you must be statutorily liable. Well, you know, if the IRS says these three sections are important for the requirement to file a return, and then when you sit down and you read them and take a look at what they say, and you see the word in there, liable, well, that has some significance. And, you know, when you compare, you know, let's take other taxes in the Internal Revenue Code, you know, like 5001 and 5005. 5001 imposes a tax on a gallon of distilled spirits. In Section 5005, they make the manufacturer or the importer of the distilled spirits liable for the tax. Well, if you're statutorily liable for the tax, you're required to comply with Section 6001 and 6011 and other provisions of the Internal Revenue Code that apply to parties liable for a tax. So this thing about being liable for a tax is nothing new. It's in the current code, and I would suggest to you that it goes all the way back to, you know, 1913 and 1916. So, Joe, if you pull up the file called liable, we can discuss it.
I'm there.
Have you got it open?
Yes.
Okay, so if you go down to the second page, and this is a 38-page PDF document, but if you go down to the second page, we're looking at a provision in the 1916 Act. It's Section 221.
I'm there.
All right, and it says that, you know, all individuals, corporations, and partnerships in whatever capacity acting, including lessees or mortgagors of real or personal property, fiduciaries, employers, and all officers and employees of the United States having the control, receipt, custody, disposal, or payment of interest, rent, salaries, wages, premiums, annuities, compensations, remunerations, emoluments, or other fixed or determinable annual or periodical gains, profits, and income of who?
Any non-resident alien individual.
Right. And then you can see down there, you know, that party having the control of income made payable to a non-resident alien shall deduct and withhold from such annual or periodic gains, profits, and income. And then if you go down a little bit further, the next page, it says, just like we have today, every such individual, corporation, partnership, referring to this withholding agent, is hereby made liable for such tax. Now, you can sit down and you can read, study the 1916 Act, looking for a section making somebody liable for the income tax. And you will see that the only one that was statutorily made liable for the tax was the withholding agent for non-resident aliens and foreign corporations as set forth in Section 211 of the 1916 Act. Is that so hard to understand?
It makes perfect sense to me.
Well, you know, in the sense that it's the only one liable, but then again, you know, it kind of introduces, you know, people begin to wonder about this. Well, why is it only the non-resident aliens? The withholding agent for non-residents. Now let's move forward. Let's go down to, you know, the fourth page in this PDF image. You can see that it's from that's the first page of the 1921 statutes at large. But then the fifth page of this image, again, it's Section 221 of the Revenue Act of 1921. And again, it reads exactly like the prior one that I read a minute ago. the only one, pursuant to Section 221 of the Revenue Act of 1921, the only one that is statutorily liable. You know, and again, you don't have to take my word for it. Just simply pull up a PDF image of that act, do an advanced word search using the word liable as the search term, and you'll get five or six different hits. But, you know, the only hit that the where liable is used in the context of being liable for the tax is the withholding agent for non-resident aliens and foreign corporations. You know, there's a couple of other little liable provisions, but in these acts, but they don't make somebody liable for the tax. They're talking about being, you know, like a deduction is allowed to somebody if they're liable for real property taxes imposed by state law. You know, well, that's not using the word liable in the context of being liable for the income tax. So in 1921, we still only have the only one that is liable for the income tax is a withholding agent for non-resident aliens and foreign corporations. You can take a look at Section 221 of that act. And moving again, Joe, down to the sixth page of this document, you can see, as I've highlighted there in yellow, every such individual corporation or partnership referring to the parties that are obligated to withhold the tax on non-resident aliens and foreign corporations is hereby made liable for such tax and is hereby indemnified against the claims and demands of any individual corporation or partnership for the amounts of any payments made in accordance with the provisions of this section. So still, in 1921, the only one that was statutorily liable for the tax was a withholding agent for non-resident aliens and foreign corporations. Now, Joe, moving down through this PDF image to page 7. Are you there? Okay, you can see this is the Revenue Act of 1924, and the eighth page of that contains section 2 contains the section 221 for the Revenue Act of 1924. And again, here you have, and remember that all of this is in lieu of, you know, they're just continuing the same scheme. They have the tax imposed in these various acts, and they're all in lieu of each other. So by this time, we're up to 1924. The 1924 tax was imposed in lieu of the tax in 1921. The 21 tax was imposed in lieu of the tax imposed by the Revenue Act of 1918, and that was in lieu of the 1916 and 1917 acts. You know, in substitution for. That's what in lieu of means. But again, you can see by means of this file that it's the withholding agent for non-resident aliens and foreign corporations that is made expressly liable for the tax, and it shows up in the statutes. Now, Joe, moving down, let's go down to the 10th page in the PDF image. And again, here we are. Let's see. This is the 26 Act. Yeah, 1926. And again, in Section 221, you know, again, our listeners can pull up these acts, run the word search for liable. You're not going to get but about five or six different hits. And when you look at the context of liable in that context, you're going to find, hey, the only party that is statutorily liable for the income tax is this guy known as what we commonly call the withholding agent for non-resident aliens and foreign corporations. And again, here in Section 221, you can see that. Am I right, Joe?
It follows the same pattern each and every year.
Yeah. And so when you get down to the 12th page in this PDF image, which incidentally is page 36 of that particular act in 1926, again, you can see, as I've highlighted there, in yellow, every such person is hereby made liable for such tax and is hereby indemnified. And the party that they're referring to is the withholding agent for non-resident aliens and foreign corporations. So even here in 1926, the only one that's statutorily liable for the tax is the withholding agent. Now let's move on to 1928. You know, by 1928, you had the income tax the pursuant to the 1916 scheme had been in effect for 10 years. And so, you know, rather than following, you know, since the Treasury Department and the Bureau of Internal Revenue were getting a lot more experience with the administration and enforcement of the income tax, there was a need to, you know, rewrite things. They still kept the in lieu of feature in the tax acts, but this new format starting in 1928 was in effect all the way up to the 1954 code. And so here you have in 1928, you know, now rather than having the withholding agents talked about in Section 221 and, you know, the tax imposed in, you know, the Section 1, now the tax is imposed in the Section 11. But now the withholding agent, pursuant to the 1928 Act, you'll find instead of it being Section 221, it is now Section 144. And again, if you read Section 144 of the 1928 Act, you know, you'll find it by simply doing a word search for liable. And once you see that, and you exclude all the other uses of liable that appear in that act, you will suddenly understand that it is, again, still the withholding agent for non-resident natives and foreign corporations is the only one who is, quote, statutorily liable for the income tax.
This is a good time to, we're going to have a break here, so let's go ahead and take a break, and then we can jump into that. So just to, for the listeners, Larry's taken us from 1913 to 1928 Act, okay, and he's said there's a slight change in the section numbers and where they put particular information, but it's still the same type of information. They've just put it in a different place. So again, if you go to truth-attack.com, Law Library section, and Primary Sources of Law menu item, you're going to see these statutes at large that Larry's referring to. We're going to try to get a better, a little more truncated information to you in the future, but we're going to come back after the break and continue with the 1928 Revenue Act. Our guest is attorney Larry Beecroft. This is Joe Bannister with the Agents for Truth Radio Show. We'll be right back after these messages.
Doctors don't want you to know about iodine because it allows the body to heal itself quickly and permanently. Iodine Now is a complete powder formulation that will load iodine into the body with vitamin C for the best possible absorption. Iodine Now, available by the case and for protection from radiation, fluoride, chlorine, and bromine, including all heavy metals. We believe that this is the main element that humans need more than any other at this time. This formulation is infused with our bioactive aerobic rare earth nutrient powder that has a powerful negative charge that attracts positive toxins. Why not buy one product that does the job of 20 and saves you space, time, and money? Has a storage life of 100 years. All for about $18 a month. Call 888-910-4367 or visit hempusa.org. Call 888-910-4367. Bringing back the universal medicine for mankind. Iodine Now. Only at hempusa.org.
Here at MyPatriotSupply.com, our customers are number one. Built on a self-sustaining business model, we don't owe our existence to big banks or big business. Instead, the company was built by you, the customer. The success of My Patriot Supply is a testimony to the loyalty and dedication of each and every one of you, to our old-fashioned values and top-rated customer service. These elements alone have made us the number one choice of patriots everywhere. We believe that being prepared should not be a luxury reserved by people with large disposable incomes, which is why we have the products you need at the prices you can afford. We bring you our Patriot Pantry brand of storable food, which features top-of-the-line flavors and carefully packed to store for 25 years. Plus water purification systems, non-GMO heirloom seeds, survival gear, and much, much more. Visit MyPatriotSupply.com or call 866-229-0927. That's 866-229-0927. MyPatriotSupply.com.
Hey, Big Mouth. Yeah, you. Listen, I want you to put the word out on the street. Tell your co-workers, your family, your paisanos, that my good friend, Joe Joseph, is doing a good thing here. He's sticking his neck out for me, for Sill, and for all the people in the world. Isn't that right, Sill?
He's part of the family now, Teach.
That's what I thought. So tune in to him right here on Freedom Link, Monday through Friday, exclusively on the Truth Frequency Radio. Yeah, they're watching you. Big deal. They're watching me, too. They're watching everybody. So grow some cojones and give them something to watch and listen to. Make them earn it. Give them paperwork until they choke. That's right. I know you won't let me down. So you're going to put the word out about my good friend, Joe Joseph, right? Good. Now do me a favor and get out of here.
My best friend gave me the best in life.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome back to the Agent for Truth radio show. Joe Bannister, your host, agentfortruth.com and freedomabovefortune.com. Our guest is attorney Larry Beecraft from Huntsville, Alabama. And so, Larry, don't want to waste any time here. We were talking about the 1928 Revenue Act and, of course, the reason why it's so important.
Now, Joe, I hope that by the time this program airs, that these people that are going to be listening to this program have the ability to download the various documents that we're talking about so they can listen to the computer and pull it up and see what we're talking about. But, you know, if that happens, then, you know, we're on page 15 of this PDF image that relates to an explanation of liable for the tax. And again, you can see still in 1928, even though they moved the section to from section 221 to section 144, they moved it to, you know, some sections, they moved around some of the sections. Still, you can see it's in the same language, and they're still only making the non-resident alien liable for the tax. And, you know, moving forward to 1932, if you go down to page 16 of that PDF image, you know, or move down to section 17, again, if you look at the 1932 Act and try to find who's liable for the federal income tax, you will see that it's the withholding agent for non-resident aliens and foreign corporations. And now it's moved up one more section. It's now in section 143, and that's the way it stays all the way up to, you know, the August of 1954. It is section 143. And again, in the 32 Act, section 143 made the only party liable for the tax was withholding agent for non-resident aliens and foreign corporations. Now, to quickly move through, because I got a couple of more points I want to cover during the course of this program. The next PDF image that you see, I moved down to page 19 of the PDF image, and you can see that's the 1934 Act. And when you move to page 20 of the PDF image for the 1934 Act, you can see section 143 contains the old provisions, just like in the 32 Act. And you can sit down and you can read it, and you can see that it's only the non-resident alien, the guy that's making payments of income, or company, that is making payments of income to a non-resident alien or a foreign corporation, they're required to deduct and withhold the tax, and they are hereby made liable for the tax. Again, only the withholding agent's liable for the tax. Moving to 1936 in this PDF image and going down to the 23rd page in this PDF image, again, you will see section 143 of this particular act. And moving to page 24, you can see that, you know, all persons in whatever capacity acting, including lessees or mortgagors of real personal property, fiduciaries, employers, and all officers and employees of the United States having the control, receipt, custody, disposal, or payment of interest, blah, 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 dividends, rent, salaries, wages, premiums, annuities, compensation, remunerations, and emoluments. If you're making those payments to a non-resident alien or a foreign corporation, you shall deduct and withhold the tax, and that party making payments of income to non-resident aliens and foreign corporations is made liable for such tax. Now, moving further down the page, let's get up to 1938. That's, you can see the first page of the statutes at large, and it's page 26 of this image. But moving to page 27 of that image, here we're dealing with section 143 of the 1938 Act. And again, section 143 dealt with withholding agents for non-resident aliens and foreign corporations. And you can plainly see that if you're making payments of income to a non-resident aliens or foreign corporation, you're required to deduct and withhold the tax. And then further down in that same section, paren C, that party is hereby made liable for such tax. Now, Joe, we're up to the 1938 Act. And remember that the 38 Act, when they codified all of the existing acts, the 38 Act went in straight into the 1939 Code. So the next, moving through this PDF image, you know, you can get down to page 31 of that image, and again, you see that section 143 of the 1938 Act became section 143 of the 1939 Code, and you can read it and see that the withholding agent for non-resident aliens and foreign corporations is still the only party liable for the tax. Now, our listeners can get all of these tax acts, download them, search through every single one of them, make a determination as to who is expressly and statutorily liable for the federal income tax. And what I have said during the course of this program is not going to be any different. You can obviously tell that I've done this in the past. It's the withholding agent, all the way up through the 1939 Internal Revenue Code. The only one that is statutorily liable for the federal income tax is that withholding agent for non-resident natives and foreign corporations. Now, Joe, let's see. Here in the, you know, the next, if you move through this PDF image, page 34, you can see that's the front page of the 1954 Internal Revenue Code. And now that was section 143 withholding agent was renumbered to section 1441 and 1461 in the 1954 code, which is the same section numbers that we have today. And you can plainly see, but then, you know, I want our listeners to download the 54 code, you know, do a search for who's liable, no, not who is liable, but just liable through all of these PDF images and analyze and study all of the hits, and you will reach the conclusion the only one that is still statutorily liable for the federal income tax is the withholding agent for non-resident natives and foreign corporations. So if today, if you are making payments of income to a non-resident alien or a foreign corporation, you're required to deduct and withhold a tax of 30%. And section 1461 of the current code, you know, that used to be expressed inside of section 143 in the 39 code, now they bust it up and create a separate independent, you know, section by itself. It becomes section 1461 of the current code. And you know, it just says these people that are making payments of income to non-resident natives and foreign corporations are hereby made liable for the tax and are indemnified from all claims and demands, just like the previous tax act. So there you can see, just by looking at, not only do does the in lieu of feature tie all of the old tax acts together, so does just an analysis of who's liable for the tax. It remains the same. And you have this odd scheme here. Well, why is the only one that is expressly, you know, made statutorily liable for the tax? Why is it limited to the withholding agent for non-resident natives and foreign corporations? Well, you know, that's the issue that confronts everybody that's interested in this question of who is required to be paying taxes and filing income tax returns. So now, Joe, you know, we only have a few minutes left in the program. There's one other important file that I want you to pull up. I don't want to miss this one, but can you pull up the income file?
Sure. And by the way, we got about 15 to 18 minutes. So
okay. Well, but this may take a few minutes, and I'd like to try to get through all these files that I emailed to you.
Okay. So you said the income file?
Yes.
Okay. So just for the listeners, there's a file that we're going to be posting, a PDF file. And it's called Extracts Tax Acts Income.
Right. They all have the same name at the front. Extracts Tax Acts. One's liable, one's income, one's remuneration, one's income. And we're on income right now. But Joe, here's, you know, you can see by means of this particular file, all of the old, you know, statutory definitions of gross income, they are included here. Now I want to, you know, I want you to flip down to this image, 36, 38. Let's go down to the, you know, everybody already knows that the section 22 of the 1938 Act became section 22 of the 1939 Code. So Joe, I want you to move down to the 23rd image in that PDF file, income.
I'm there.
Okay. Now, read the general definition there that's in yellow on that page.
This is section 22A, general definition. Gross income includes gains, profits, and income derived from salaries, wages, or compensation for personal service of whatever kind and in whatever form paid, or from professions, vocations, trades, businesses, commerce, or sales, or dealings
okay,
in property.
That's good, Joe.
Okay.
You know, it goes on. What's important for our discussion right now, what I want to point out, is here you have the statutory definition of gross income. Now, here's something that may be confusing to people, but, you know, let's take a look at a rule of statutory construction. Every word in an act means something. And when you see this phrase, gains, profits, and income, they're not equal to each other. You know, they each one stands separately independent and has a different meaning than the other words. And that's and the reason for that is because there's a rule of statutory construction that every word means something, and, you know, a legislative body doesn't include, useless words in an act. So if gains was equal to profits and gains was equal to income, they would have just said only income here. But then again, since they include the words salaries, wages, or compensation for personal services in there, then this means that salaries is distinctly different from wages, although some people would sit there and say, they all kind of mean the same thing. For the act itself, since you see the word salaries there, it's different from wages. But then again, both salaries and wages are different from compensation for personal service. Do you follow that, Joe?
Yes.
Okay. You can't come along and say that these words all mean the same thing. If you do that, then you're ignoring a rule of statutory construction that you must give meaning to every word in a law. And that means also going a step further that trades are different from vocations, and vocations are different from businesses. And the reason why they have to be different is because the legislature, Congress, comes along and includes these words in these acts. And so when you're engaged in statutory construction, trying to determine what the words of a law mean, you got to give meaning to every act. So would you now agree, Joe, that salaries, wages, and compensation for personal services are all different in some way?
Yes, they're different, and they're all mentioned distinctly, distinct different words in the statute.
Okay, now, let's move down, go down a couple pages in that same file, and we will see section 61. Now, when you read the Senate and House reports on the 54 Code, they'll tell you what they were doing. Section 22 of the 1939 Code became section 61 of the 1954 Code. The cross references say that. The House and the Senate reports say that. But something is different, Joe. Can you look and see what might be missing? What was left out in this transition from Section 22 of the 1939 Code to Section 61 of the 54 Code?
Looks like they definitely left out gains, profits, and income derived from.
Right. And what else?
I don't see wages or salaries.
Yeah, it starts off with compensation for services, right?
I'm sure that was a coincidence, right? Right, Larry?
Well, I'm just simply pointing out, the reason why you got to look closely at these things and see what's there and follow it through. But now, Joe, you yourself have said, in Section 22 of the 1939 Code had the words wages and salaries and compensation for personal services. But now, starting off with Section 61 of the 1954 Code, the first thing that comes out is compensation for services.
That's right.
Now, Joe, let's say that it's 1924, and you've seen, let's say it's 1935. You're the commissioner of Internal Revenue. You would come out with a set of regulations, and you would want uniformity in construction. You want everybody that works in your department, under your command, you want everybody to be on the same page. They all construe the tax law uniformly. But then you're looking at Section 22. If this is in 1935, you'd be looking at the Revenue Act of 1934, and there would be Section 22, and it would say salaries, wages, and compensation for personal services. Don't you think it would be important for the Commissioner of Internal Revenue in his regulations to ensure uniformity of meaning? Don't you think that the Commissioner would tell us what compensation for personal services is?
That would be a good place to do it, right, in the regulations.
All right, so now here's the challenge I want to issue to our listeners. Go through, you can see compensation for personal services, compensation for services, in all of that stuff. So you get those old tax regulations, and I'm not going to tell you what it says, but you try to find where the commissioner provides some type of definition or description as to what compensation for personal services is. And once you do that, you'll see, wow, it's amazingly consistent over the decades. And then after you do that, then now most people are going to sit here and take a look at Section 61 and print one, compensation for personal services. Most people are going to sit there, oh, I know what that is. Don't you think most people are going to sit there and say, when they're looking at that, well, I get is compensation for services. Isn't that the natural gut reaction when somebody that's uneducated about this, when he sits down and reads the words, don't you think that's the conclusion most people are going to draw, Joe?
Right, it's much more generic in the newer Section 61.
Well, I think we ought to follow what the commissioner says. And I think that if people would look at the current, you know, definition that is provided by the Commissioner of Internal Revenue as to what compensation for services is, you know, they might say, hey, I need to educate myself a little bit more as to what compensation for services are. And that's one of the things that's very beneficial when you sit out and engage in a study. Most people wouldn't find it. Well, most people wouldn't understand this unless they've gone back and taken a look at the old tax acts. Now, Joe, here's another point I want to make. We've already talked about being statutorily liable for the tax, and we've covered during the course of this program the fact that, you know, statutorily, the party designated as being liable for the federal income tax is this guy known as the withholding agent for non-resident natives and foreign corporations. Now, that guy could be an individual, a trust, a corporation, a partnership, you know, a homeowners association, you know, any number one of entities. Hey, man, you know, any of these entities that are making payments of income to a non-resident native and foreign corporation, you're liable for the tax. You're required to deduct and withhold the tax. Now, along that same line, if you go back to, say, like the Revenue Act of 1918, I would encourage our listeners to make a determination. Well, who is subject to withholding? You know, they had, since we've talked about withholding, you know, what about wages? And, you know, if you study this old stuff, you will see that, yes, there was wage withholding under the old tax acts. But guess who they were limited to, Joe?
Well, let me guess. Non-resident aliens?
Well, yeah, the withholding agent would deduct and withhold from wages paid to non-resident aliens and foreign corporations. They would deduct and withhold the tax. Just like we were talking about earlier, the withholding agent. If he's making payments of wages, now here's something that's a little odd too. When you take a look at the definition of wages, it's gains, profits, and income derived from wages, salaries, and compensation for personal services. If it's derived from, it's, you know, there's some unique difference between, you know, what's derived from and the actual thing itself, wages or salaries. However, when you get over into the withholding provisions, now they actually withhold on wages, salaries. But it's in reference to non-resident aliens and foreign corporations. And I would like to challenge our listeners to see, gee, you know, all the way up through the 1939 Internal Revenue Code, you know, who else was subjected to wage withholding under the 1939 Internal Revenue Code? And that's, you know, it's real important for people to get this concept in their head that, you know, there's been wage withholding since the beginning, since 1916. The withholding agent for non-resident natives and foreign corporations has, since that time, been deducting and withholding income taxes from wages paid to non-resident natives and foreign corporations. So that brings up the very interesting question. Well, when did it get expanded? Well, the alleged expansion, most people today would think, oh, it happened during World War II. Well, if you take a look at the current wage withholding provisions, you know, in reference to wage withholding in reference to the income tax, that's section 34.1, 34.2 of the current 1986 code. But where did those provisions come from? You know, the history of that shows that it comes from the current Tax Payment Act of 1943. But then the current Tax Payment Act of 1943, it was enacted to replace a temporary wartime tax, which was called the Victory Tax, which was imposed in 1942. So in 1942, Congress comes along and imposes this Victory Tax Act, and it had withholding provisions regarding wages. That was in effect for about a year, and then after about a year, Congress comes along, and, you know, there were a lot of people have even read the debates regarding the current Tax Payment Act. You know, people are familiar with the role that Beardsley Rummel played in devising wage withholding, but the Victory Tax Act was repealed and replaced by the current Tax Payment Act. And it's the current Tax Payment Act. That current Tax Payment Act became, you know, I think it was section 1621 of the 1939 code. And then when they reshuffled the 39 code to create the 54 code, those withholding provisions under Section 1621 of the 1939 Code, which was the current Tax Payment Act, that became Sections 3401 and 3402 of the 1954 Code, and again, 3401 and 3402 for the 1986 Code. So, you know, if people would sit down and just study, you know, I'm not suggesting that you have to master everything, but I am suggesting that you at least become familiar with it. And once you become familiar with it, you know, it's been my experience that people will sit down and study this stuff and think about it over a period of time. You know, if you learn something this week, it'll still be, it may even very well be on your mind next week. Well, now you've just added, you know, new information to your reservoir of knowledge. And, you know, once you get, you know, it gets in your head, hey, this is the way it was, then you go back a couple of weeks later and study it again. It becomes a lot more embedded in your brain. It becomes knowledge. And it's real important for people to know about all these little things, like, you know, why do we have this thing about, you know, Section 22 of the 39 Code containing wages and salaries, but Section 61 of the 54 Code does not. And, you know, what is compensation for services? You know, what is compensation for labor? You know, are the two the same thing? These are all very interesting questions. And today, since we have computers, since we have the ability to engage in searches through PDF images of these legal documents, we have something that was unavailable to us in years in the past. You know, if you go back into, you know, the 80s and 90s, the 70s, you know, even into the late 90s, we didn't have this material available to us. However, now it's available. People don't have to go jump in their car and drive down to a law library. You can just simply get it off the internet. And if we had a bunch of people studying, you know, then we would be discussing these, you know, oddball features of these tax acts. And, you know, once we become familiar with these things, hey, now we're making some progress. Now we can get further down the road. But we will not get further down the road, you know, unless some people at least devote some time to studying this stuff so that they see what the issues are. You know, one of the things that really irritates me about, you know, this group of people that, you know, study the tax laws that the government calls a bunch of tax protesters, you know, one of the things that really disappoints me is, you know, there are too many people that just, well, I just, you know, I heard some rumor and hearsay. You know, Irwin Schiff says thus and such, and I spent a few minutes looking at Irwin's book, and you know, I just kind of emotionally agree with him. Well, that isn't going to hack it. You know, those types of people, you know, they're basically cannon fodder for the government. And until they sit down and master this stuff, we're going to continue to be that way. But then again, we're going to still have to come together. There are a lot of important issues that must be resolved, and these are legal issues, so we must carefully plan what we're going to do. And if we would take that course of action, carefully plan what we're going to do, and, you know, carry out legal battles that need to be carried out, you know, there may very well be the great possibility that we can achieve our goals of victory in our favor. Don't you think that's possible, Joe?
I think it completely is, and you're basically telling me and the listeners, you know, there's no substitute for doing your homework.
Right.
When we were kids, maybe some more than others, would just figure, well, we can get away with, you know, passing the test next week if we don't really study. And just like you said, I mean, Irwin Schiff has brought a lot of information to people's attention, but that's not enough. You need to use that as a springboard into the depths of the paper trail that makes up this 100 years of income taxation that we've been subjected to. And that's what's so important, and that's why I'd like to have you on the show now and then. And let's see, we probably only have a minute
and
a half.
Okay, well, there's another file, you know, it's called remuneration. You know, we didn't have a chance to discuss that. But again, you know, you can see the value, what these files are just certain points. You know, you pull out the pages from the tax acts, put them together chronologically. You know, like this file regarding remuneration, it's 54 pages long, but it includes, you know, a lot of the real important points that you want to make in the tax acts regarding remuneration. Joe, do you know what remuneration is? Joe, why is there always some odd connection, you know, that remuneration is different from wages? And yet today, you know, wages are defined as remunerations. You know, why do you have this odd connection with non-resident aliens and foreign corporations? You know, there's just a lot of interesting questions, but you know, there's no way that we can discuss those until people sit down and do some basic study. And I'm saying that, you know, the basic study is not difficult, and it's easy to do, a lot easier to do today than in decades of the past. And the reason why it's a lot easier is because now we can do word searches. And I don't know anybody that can't do some basic word searching through a PDF document and then, you know, study the document. Whoa, you know, here I see something here. You know, it's kind of repetitive. You know, there's a pattern here. And once they understand the pattern, then they can move on to something that's a little bit more complicated.
Right.
But, you know, until we get down to the basics, you know, you can't only even carry on a discussion with somebody about these, you know, more complicated points regarding the income tax.
Right. Well, Larry, thank you very, very much for coming on the show. And we're going to try to
get these documents
posted out on the Internet so that people can listen and study while they're listening. And that's the whole purpose. So we appreciate you being the professor in this regard. And but now it's up to the students to get out and do some homework. And we can't hold their hand anymore, right? Now it's time to crack the books.
Joe, you have a good weekend.
Okay, thank you, Larry. You take care of yourself.
All right, bye.
Bye-bye. Well, ladies and gentlemen, that was Larry Beecraft, and thank you very much for joining us on the Agent for Truth Radio Show, and we will see you next time. Take care.